Welcome to the lifestyle segment of Conscious Leaders. Leadership isn't just about what happens in the boardroom. It's about curiosity, understanding the way we live our lives. It's about how we take care of ourselves, how we manage our time, and how we create balance in our lives. This is the way we live, and it impacts the way we lead. So, let's dive in and discover how we can make conscious lifestyle choices that's not only there to improve our lives, but also to enhance the way we show up as leaders.
Yessie, I am being helped today. How about you? Carmen, by saying sorry, you are telling everybody around you that you can't take up space in the room around you. Mm. That hit me hard, like a ton of bricks.
People you meet are going to like you. 1 in 5 people are just going to dislike you. And 3 in 5 people are going to be agnostic about you. But inner sovereignty is where self-esteem comes from. Can I tell you how to get self-esteem?
Tell me.
Okay.
All ears.
So if the masculine can turn on the feminine and the feminine can turn on the masculine, which in this case is asserting boundaries and taking our power back, then we become a real force of power to be reckoned with.
And to have it succinct, because you know, a woman speaks over 7,000 words a day and a man is average 3,000. We speak a lot, right?
Technical term is love bombing. Right, and inclusion isn't what you think. It's not what I thought.
Explain.
So we must also remember that feedback should be positive as well.
But it sounds like a lot of work. We've all taught that anger is a bad emotion, right? But what you're saying is it actually shows you where your boundary needs to be.
Mm-hmm. You go on the great adventure of the truth, and you just learn to tell the truth. So we have to understand that there's some programming there, an initial resistance that we need to overcome. And I call that the default.
Mm, I love that. Don't you like that?
Because here's something interesting. Most people just want to make you feel how they feel. And emotions have wisdom, right? So sadness is telling me I need to grieve something. It's going from my life and it's sweeping me clean, in the words of Rumi, for some new delight.
I like to call it gut vesting.
Uh-huh.
So investing. So the more... Oh, I love that. Love that. I've got many more. Wait.
You probably will compromise friendships. Those people aren't your friends. Right, they're people who are vampires and they want stuff from you, and you're useful to them, and they will continue to take stuff until they get it from you.
My husband has a word for that: social climbing.
Right. So social climbing, right? And I know a little bit about you because we're friends, and your journey has been intuitive. It was non-logical to do some of the things you've done.
Right? I know. Well, there you have it. To be a conscious leader is not just about the question that you ask yourself as how I can lead with greatness, but the call of a conscious leader is how can I bring the greatness out in those around me. So, hey, conscious leaders, a warm welcome to yet another episode. And today we are going to touch on leadership, and we're going to talk about boundaries. Boundaries is often conceived as being something that makes us feel uncomfortable, but it's all about you. It's all about setting a way of how you want to be treated, but also it's so important in order for you to take your power back. So many times when you don't set boundaries, things happen and you are treated in a different way, but often it actually comes back to us as people and how we set boundaries. But I also just want to take it back a step. So we've done a lot of research in the past 6 months, especially with women, trying to understand the issues that women deal with from boardroom to living room. And we really want to understand also from generation to generation the challenges that we face as women. And we really wanted to take these insights and bring you episodes that can, with experts, that can actually elevate your understanding of it, but also why it is important for you to step up and take your power back. And this is why I'm bringing in a very special guest, David Joshua. Now, David Joshua, interesting story is I went to Henley Business School on a professional communications course, and really just take that program is really just elevating your skills in communication. But then I actually went to David and I said to him, listen, I want you to do one-on-one coaching with me, because I was busy with this massive pitch that I wanted to take forward with corporate, and really just to sell the idea and to have it succinct, because, you know, a woman speaks over 7,000 words a day and a man is average 3,000. We speak a lot, right? So that was the challenge, right? It was trying to make everything succinct. Mm. And in the end of the day, we just started off one of our sessions. And this was where the big penny dropped, because I did not stop apologizing. And David stopped me and he said to me, stop apologizing. Mm-hmm. And that, and then he explained to me why, which we're going to get into, and how this actually interconnects with boundaries and how you want to be treated, and also how you need to take your power back in the smallest of actions when it comes to communicating your power. So without further ado, David.
Hello.
My gosh, all the way from Cape Town, UK. I don't know which one is the best home to explain.
From Cape Town on my way to London and then back again. But I call this country, South Africa, my home. But I do work extensively in the UK as well.
Yeah, and you've got the accent. Sorry, got to say that.
Thank you.
Okay, so I think before we even get started, it would be so wonderful if you can maybe give us context as to why you are in the game of the art of communication and helping executives with their communication skills and how to, you know, run the world of corporate and to take their power back.
I would love to start there. So I was in a job working for a toxic leader. And when I say that, I don't say it lightly. He made a senior director cry twice in one afternoon. He was not a fun person to work for. And I knew that within a matter of weeks. But 18 months later, I was still in that role. And you understand the implications to your mental health and well-being that has. So when I finally got offered a job interview for a role that really appealed to me, I was, shall we say, invested in being successful. And the first round, I met with a gatekeeper and I aced it. In the second round, I met with the CEO of an international bank and I got through to the final round, and it was maybe one other person. And I walked into that room and I was asked to give a 5-minute presentation at the beginning. And so I walk into a boardroom and there are 6 men sitting on the other side, and I choked. My voice started trembling, my hands started tremoring, my face flushed, my heart raced. And if you've ever taken your driving test, you might know that if you hit the curb, the pavement, you instantly fail, but they make you finish the test. I know, because I had a friend who that happened to. And I just felt like I didn't want to be there. I instantly failed within the first minute and had to sit through this interview. And I walked out of that experience understanding the reason why wisdom texts talk about the word as a sacred, powerful technology at the heart of everything. And I understood that my life would be full of resentment and unfulfilled potential unless I could master the word. Mm. And so from that position, within just a few years, I now give the lectures on impactful and influential communication at a world-class business school. And that really set me on a journey of how we can empower ourselves.
Mm. And I mean, It's so profound, and it's sometimes these little tweaks that you need to do in your own behavior. Mm. But I want to take it back to that moment, right? And I think we can be vulnerable here. So grab yourself a chair, pen and paper, because you're going to learn a lot, right? And we're going to go through real life examples also a little bit later on in order to see, you know, how you deal with boundaries and how you can set these boundaries. But I mean, in that moment when you said to me, Carmen, stop saying sorry, I wouldn't say it was a trigger. It was almost, I took a step back and I almost felt like I went into the past. And I sat there and I was like, oh my word, I really do apologize a lot. And you know, being mindful of it now is really, it's something that you need to keep working on. But I think the big thing for me was, we as women are often programmed to be good girls and to be nice and to behave and raised in a very different way. So the moment when we set boundaries, we mistake them for, you know, because we've often been told of being a certain stereotype when we are robust and we say, listen, this is a boundary you've overstepped. And so many situations can be avoided if we actually just set the boundaries. But it's not always easy, because there's a difference between being nice and being kind. Mm. And I really think that it has a lot to do with me first. If I if I say sorry too much, the one thing you said to me was, Carmen, by saying sorry, you are telling everybody around you that you can't take up space in the room around you. Mm. That hit me hard, like a ton of bricks. So I want you to elaborate on that for us.
Okay. So this is at the heart of everything to do with being female, in my understanding. So I think let's start at first principles. The world is comprised, or rather your cognitive mind perceives, a world made of comparative polarity, right? So high defines low, good defines evil, light, dark, masculine, feminine. That's the polarity we're going to be talking about today. Now, the masculine is what goes out and sets boundaries, hunts wild beasts, defends the enemy from tribes with ill intent. So there's that confrontational aspect to the masculine. And we call that, we measure that in psychology as disagreeable. Mm. Okay. So masculine, and I'm talking about gender, not sex here, and it's a bell curve distribution. Disagreeable people tend to be males, but all the very disagreeable people are male, right? And the same is true of this trait called agreeableness. Now, agreeableness, there's great evolutionary reasons for women being agreeable. And those are, until recently, a woman's role in a tribe was to raise and care for children. Children don't have cognitive intellectual minds until the age of about 6. And that means they are purely feeling beings, right? They just have emotions for the first 6 years of their life. Mm. What is the optimal state to raise a child? It's one of harmony, right? So women will sacrifice their own needs to create harmony, and they are also programmed at some biological level, most of them, to actually seek that over defending their own and asserting their own boundaries. So we have to understand that there's some programming there, an initial resistance that we need to overcome. And I call that the default, right? So our job is to go from the default to the whole and the complete, which is the meaning of the yin and the yang, that beautiful symbol where we have the light and the dark, the masculine and feminine, surrounded by a circle. Because if the masculine can turn on the feminine and the feminine can turn on the masculine, which in this case is asserting boundaries and taking our power back, then we become a real force of power to be reckoned with.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. So let's get into the meat and the juice of boundaries and why it matters. Like, especially, you know, I think when we engage with the world out there, like, it's very easy when you're in your family environment, you know, to set boundaries and how you want to be treated or how things need to rock and roll. But I mean, in the end of the day, is when you in the outside world, there is a lot of situations that comes towards you. And, you know, there's a lot that comes with a sacrifice. Like, I'll just give a context. Say, for example, you're sitting in a boardroom and you are being mistreated, or your voice is not being heard, or your ideas are not being heard. You know, in that moment, if you don't deliver your boundary correctly, that this could actually compromise your job.
Okay.
And there's a lot of like, oh, I have to show up as a man, which I feel is so incorrect. I feel that we as feminine, as our feminine sides, can still bring our strength to the table, but differently. But we've learned the language of a male system. And I feel that we perhaps need to take it a step back and just introspect as to why the boundaries are important and why and how can we reframe the way that we think about boundaries.
Okay, and I love what you've touched on there. There's great evidence, that irrefutable evidence, that women make better leaders than men. And that's for precisely the reasons
that I'm saying, yes, yes.
It's for precisely the reasons I've articulated. Women have this ability to create harmony, resonance at an emotional level. So Google looked at what creates a high-performing team, and the result they found was stunning. The number one determining factor of a high-performing team by a long way is the presence or absence of psychological safety. And I think that's better described as emotional safety, right? And again, the evolutionary reasons are excellent, right? Women have a moon water every 28 days. What that means is a woman goes into her emotions and into her body every month. Me, I've raised with the sun every day and I go to bed with the dark in my head. Right. Men have to do serious work to get out of their heads and into their hearts. Women often are already there, which is why men can be so infuriating for you. Right. We just have different intelligences that we run. There are three: the head, which operates on thought, the body, which operates on sensation, and the heart, which operates on feeling. So those are the reasons why women make better leaders than men.
I love that. Don't you just love that? Okay, sorry, I just had to do that. Mm-hmm. But okay, let's take it a step back. You know, if we look at imposter syndrome, I mean, we sometimes, I feel, over crutch on the word imposter syndrome. It's like the excuse for us not to show up. Mm. What's your view on that?
Okay, so relating that to what I just said, the masculine asserts itself, and the feminine is more comfortable creating harmony. When there's disharmony, we need to be courageous and we need to address the disharmony. So Gandhi said, peace is not the absence of conflict, it's the ability to deal with it. Now, agreeable people, the feminine, is conflict averse. And interestingly, so am I. I've had to teach myself this. So when we feel we have imposter syndrome, or when we feel like we shouldn't be speaking up or there's conflict, we have to understand, and you've heard this before, we have to get uncomfortable to grow, because zones of growth happen when we are uncomfortable. So relating it back to imposter syndrome, number one, there's the excuse, which I think you're alluding to, that actually, I shouldn't be here, I don't want to do it, and therefore I won't. But second of all, and this is really important, there's the cultivation of inner power that makes me understand that I'm enough and I don't need external validation. And that's really the only way to overcome imposter syndrome. I'll give you a really cool example. I was working at Henley Business School, and I was working with a large accounting and consulting firm for newly minted directors. These people, by any metric, had made it. There are about 20 of them. And towards the end of the second day together, they each did a short talk. And I asked each of them, lining up, how they felt their talk had gone. One woman said, great. Everyone else said something self-deprecating, right? Then I asked all of them how they felt their colleagues had done. Everyone said, amazing. And these people were competent. They'd all done well, right? But they couldn't bring themselves to affirm themselves. And the work, capital T, capital W, the work of the second half of life is to take our power back from needing affirmation and validation from the outside world to understanding our intrinsic value in a way that is sovereign and heartfelt.
Mm. I love that. I want to ask you your opinion on something that really triggers me as an individual. Is especially when we as women talk a lot, right? We're not the most succinct. Well, some people have the gift, okay? Some people just have the gift of the gab, but it's not always the case for everyone. There's actually research, as I mentioned before, that states that women speak an average of 7,000 words a day, whereas a man is up to 2,000 or 3,000 words a day. Okay. So we do talk a lot, and there's a lot of social experiments that have been done where women feel that they need to explain things more to be understood.
Mm-hmm.
And many times when you are explaining yourself, you'll often hear somebody say to you, I think what you're trying to say. And it's a very triggering thing.
Mm-hmm.
How do you set a boundary with that?
Okay, I love this example. So the first thing I would say is the feedback is real. We need to be more concise. We live in an attention-starved world where, if you think about how I always say to people, you have about 5 to 10 seconds to capture people's attention. And one of the common things that women come to me for coaching for is a lack of impact. So I like boxing, right? And we want to be pop, pop, bang, okay? Making our points rather than doing this to people, because it's just confusing. There's a deluge of information. So the first thing is take responsibility for becoming more impactful, more concise. And the difference between men and women here is the head is logical and the heart is nonlinear. And so women speak from the heart, which is a superpower because it's charged with emotion, but it also needs to be married with logic. What we want is both, right? So back to your question, if you get triggered by somebody saying, I think what you're saying is, first of all, take it as feedback that maybe you could be more concise and more logical. You can turn that on. And second of all, I think I would just leave it there. I mean, in terms of overriding.
No, but I mean,
somebody,
when it happens a lot, I also need to say it doesn't always mean that the person is not like. This is the interruption part, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we as women deal a lot with you know, let me finish, let me get my point across before you interrupt.
Oh, so an interruption. So
it's like, almost like an interruption. I think what you're trying to say.
Okay. And there it's important to say, may I finish my point?
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Exactly.
There's an idea by Nancy Klein, which I really like, which is The Promise. And it's just called The Promise. And the promise is not to interrupt. And it changes your life when you live that promise.
Mm.
Because you actually don't know what you're going to say. And when people interrupt you, what they're actually saying is, my thoughts are more important than yours.
Mm.
Now, the paradox we're going to be dealing with a lot here is, you can only change yourself and your reaction to people, and you can't really change others.
Yeah,
right? And so some people are programmed to interrupt, and it's frustrating, and you can flag it. But quite often, we need to just assume that our work is transcending those triggers while also patrolling and maintaining our boundaries.
Mm. You know what's very interesting, although this is a topic completely that goes off the charts here, that's obviously not what this conversation is about. I'm learning a lot also about being neurodiverse and then the condition of being neurodiverse and how that also works in terms of interruption and how, you know, you sometimes trying to validate your story and put yourself in the story without knowing that you're doing it, but it's actually just to show empathy and how our brains are completely conditioned differently. And I'm learning a lot about, you know, there's no black and white about the human condition and how we also operate. It's having an understanding and having these kind of dialogues that is so important in order to look at different perspectives, but it brings it back to authenticity, right?
Right.
Because if you're not authentic and you're not saying how you feel or you're not able to express how you feel, then we can't meet halfway.
And the authenticity thing is, you know, there's so many Instagram quotes on authenticity.
Mm.
But authenticity is the hardest thing to earn. And you have you have to earn it.
Mm.
And again, it's the capital D, capital W. The work of the second half of life is becoming authentic. What we need to do is we need to, first of all, transcend the ego that has multiple subpersonalities in its head, which flare up. I have some that tell me to get a beer out the fridge on a Monday morning, which I had to overcome. I've got ones that have self-sabotaging thoughts. You know, there are many, many different voices in my head, and that's actually how psychologists think of it. And we need to get to our intuitive self, right? Now, developing your intuition, which operates on feelings. Remember, the ego, the intellect operates on thoughts. That requires us to be uncomfortable and actually process emotion, legacy trauma, and become okay and wise enough to see the wisdom of emotions without becoming enslaved to them. And that is a really, really difficult thing to do.
Very difficult. And I think also, just to go back to that, I think this is also something where we get lost with our boundaries. And I think this is just the human race, is where we don't know who our authentic selves are. So we haven't done the work. We know what this person is saying to us. It's not feeling right in our bodies, but we take it.
Mm.
Rather than saying, I don't know why what you've said is just triggering to me, or if it's just me, but it does. It's not sitting well with me. And, you know, it's important to actually vocalize it.
And I love what you just said there. It's a feeling in the body. Okay, so there are three intelligences. One is the gut. It's the second brain. You're not thinking about breathing or growing your fingernails, right? So,
well, yeah, some cases.
So I pinch myself, physical sensation. My gut will tell me you shouldn't be down this alley, or whatever it is, right? We have this sixth sense, which is in the gut. It's instinct. And then we have this heartfelt intuition, which again operates on feeling. Right. And we don't have scientific instruments to measure that, but we all know it because we've all experienced it.
Mm.
So many of the clients I coach and many of my friends talk about having lost touch with their instinct and their intuition. And I think that's part of the journey of life. We all get wounded. We all get traumatized. And really, becoming whole is a delayering, a de-armoring, a reconnecting, and starting to trust ourselves. And what you just said there was so interesting. I feel like my boundaries are being breached. Now, what is that feeling? And there are five emotions, okay? There's mad, there's sad, there's scared, there's creative, there's joyful. Okay, joyful, wonderful when it happens. Creative includes sexual energy, but we're gonna focus on the three trigger emotions, right?
Mm.
So mad, sad, scared. The boundary being breached is anger. It's mad. I get angry, and different people have their own physical tell. One lady I worked with recently, it's a burning sensation running up to her ears. For me, it's this expansive, it's like a non-audible ringing where I just can feel myself getting triggered, right? Now, if we don't have connection with sacred anger, okay, what happens is we don't have a boundary. And now we should be scared and we potentially should be sad because we can't regulate ourselves and we can't fulfill our own destiny because we can't advocate on our own behalf. I'd like you to think about it like this. Imagine I'm in a brand new Land Cruiser and I'm going down a very, very rainy, slippery mountain. Okay. I feel pretty good because I've got the maximum amount of control and the headlights are working and the window wipers are working. Now I'm on a motorbike with no flashlight. I feel terrified because I don't have protection. So one of the things I work with a lot of people is I ask them, how often do you get angry? Many people tell me, I don't get angry at all. That's a problem because your anger is your boundary and every other emotion depends on you being able to have boundaries and connecting with anger in a way that is healthy and integrated.
You know, that's quite profound because we've all taught that anger is a bad emotion, right? But what you're saying is it actually shows you where your boundary needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can you elaborate a little bit more about that? Because, I mean, where is the disconnect? Because there needs to be an element of control when you're angry as well. You have to apply the emotional intelligence, emotional regulation, because you've got people to deal with. But at the same time, is anger is also a healthy emotion.
Right. So what we do in modern society is we either repress it, what you repress depresses you, and then you have a mountain of anger inside of you. Men are often highly frustrated and they go dead behind the eyes because of this, okay? The other extreme is you express it unconsciously because here's something interesting. Most people just want to make you feel how they feel. And I know I have to
I love that.
Right?
I know that.
What it's like if you're in an intimate relationship. You can pass the emotion on and then you no longer have to deal with it. But ultimately, that's obviously not a lovely thing to do. So then it becomes, can we process? Can we be skillful? Can we unblock? Can we process the legacy emotions that we've been storing up for so long? And that's uncomfortable. But once we get to that point, we get into connected with the anger in the moment. And emotions have wisdom, right? So sadness is telling me I need to grieve something. It's going from my life and it's sweeping me clean, in the words of Rumi, for some new delight, right? So that's sad. Scared is telling me to pay attention, right? My instinct is saying this is a moment that matters. And anger is telling me your boundaries are at risk here. Now, it could be that my mental models are faulty, right? And I get angry at you because I have expectations that are not valid. So the first thing we want to do is be self-reflective. Is it reasonable for me to be getting angry? But then if it is, now I know where my boundaries are.
And it's also evaluating the value system, right?
That.
Because you need to almost go back to say, okay, right, this is sitting well with me. How do I have boundaries versus guardrails? You know, I still want to have boundaries, but be kind, not being nice.
Mm-hmm.
Because I also think that this is something I can speak for myself. Sometimes when I put boundaries in place, I can literally, when you've overstepped the line with me, I have a hard wall.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's hard. Whereas maybe it would be, what do you call it? Those fencing? Is it pilastrates? What is the fencing that you can see through?
I know the one you mean.
You know, yes. Like it's almost like I want to put up the guards that you can know that this is a boundary. And people also need to know when they overstep the boundary.
Uh-huh.
Because so often we think other people know what that boundary is.
Uh-huh.
And they don't.
No.
And it's something by what you feel, right?
Right. So expectations create resentments. And we expect people to know our boundaries. And one of the things is, if you're getting new to patrolling your boundaries, you're going to make mistakes. I know I have and I know I still do. But the gift of the East, and I'm talking Eastern philosophy, Taoism, and I'm talking Buddhism, is detachment, right? And detachment means I am not going to add emotional fuel to the fire. Very different if I come at you and say, when I'm triggered, you know what that is like. It's not, and I teach this for a living, and occasionally I still get triggered, and afterwards I watch myself, and I go, I just got caught,
yeah.
Right? because we want to detach when we give our perspective, and curiosity is a very good emotion for doing that. But importantly, detach from what? Detach from the ego, detach from the emotion, and get aligned with our values, which you've mentioned. And yet most people don't know what they stand for, and therefore they start patrolling boundaries randomly and don't have this sovereignty and consistency which marks authentic leaders.
Yeah, and it's so true what you say, because you know, when you know this is what I stand for, this is my value system, and you put that boundary in place, you're consistent with it. Whereas if you don't know what the value system is behind the boundary, you sometimes have a hypocrisy that's at play.
Exactly. And you know, I know as I've developed in my growth, inverted commas spiritual, or just becoming into integrity, authenticity, now my boundaries are kind of self-fulfilling. A bit like what you said, the boundary just goes up. You know, a friend tried to sell me some network marketing a couple of months ago, and I just very quickly, just dispassionately said, this is not a friendship if you're going to start using me for monetization. Boom, 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 boundary. I didn't think about that because the boundaries become more natural. So the great paradox, and life is a paradox, is that the more we work on ourselves, and Carmen said something to me just as we walked in here, the inner creates the outer. And that's a principle, perhaps the most profound principle in life. The more I start to understand myself, the more automatic and aligned my boundaries are going to become.
And you know, it's so important that you're mentioning that, because I think where I'm really reflecting a lot in my life right now is this whole idea of why did I have to wait to be so old in my life to learn this lesson, where I feel like having these conversations are so important for the younger generations, that they can kind of learn how to set boundaries in a very affirmative and assertive way without feeling like they are doing something wrong and carrying this guilt. And, you know, overcoming that guilt was a journey, but it's so liberating when you know that you can actually put boundaries in place. And you know that's good for everybody, and it creates healthy relationships, because eventually as you start doing the boundaries and you start setting those healthy boundaries, you very soon start learning who is good friends, who's not.
Okay. And I love what you've touched on here, right? How do we set a boundary? It's to the highest good. So
yeah.
It's my highest good that I'm patrolling first. Remember, agreeable people sacrifice their own self-interest. That does not serve you or anyone else in the long term, right? And then you'll become a martyr and you'll become resentful. So don't
love that.
Right?
A martyr. Oh, my word. My husband used to say that word a lot to me when I was a younger version.
Beautiful. Right. Thank you for sharing. And we learn through suffering, and we have to learn through these things. And so we ask, what are my values? What is it that I am aiming at? And is this aligned? So when people ask me something, I will, if it's aligned with me and it's aligned with you, blessings. But if it's something that goes against my self-interest, then I'm probably going to start becoming resentful for doing it down the line. And one of the things I ask women to do when I coach them is have a default no.
Explain.
So somebody asks you for something, your first response is no.
Without explaining yourself,
no,
right?
No, you can explain. But I just, you know, many of the women I work with have a default yes. So they will say, yes, I would love to help you.
Oh, that's so true.
And then they get resentful, and then they do it, and they don't do it with love, and then it's a problem. Whereas if we can just say, and again, we'll maybe come on to this, but we'll do it now. You know, let's say a man comes up to your desk, and he isn't your line manager, and says, hey, could you just do this for me? It's not the first time it's happened. A surprising number of women come to me for coaching on this issue, right? So what I teach them to do is ground. So we'll do this together now. It'll only take a few moments. So just wiggle your toes for me. Close your eyes. When you move your awareness into your toes, it's going into the intelligence of your body. Now move it into your breath. Imagine breathing up through your legs and breathing any negativity down through your toes. Awareness in the toes or the breath. You might already feel yourself relaxing, and that's because awareness is mutually exclusive. It can only be in one place at one time. Now we're out the intelligence of the head, we're out the intelligence of the emotions. Head creates stories, emotions create feelings. Now we're just in sensation. So now I'm not being triggered by this person in front of me, and I can converse. So come back into the room. The next thing I teach is have a mantra ready, because the worst time to think of what you need to say is when you need to say it.
Mm.
Right? So we just...
that's brilliant advice.
Okay. So somebody comes to me, they ask me for something. I don't know if it's reasonable or not, but I also don't want to decide in that moment, and I also don't want to say yes. So I say, thank you. Do you mind if I just take a few moments to consider it, and I'll come by your desk a little later? Maybe that's your mantra, right? But we're just buying ourselves time. We don't have to say no, but we just say, and then what'll often happen is, if you're overwhelmed at work, you can then prepare yourself, and you can say, these are all the projects I have on. What is it you would have me deprioritize to do this by the deadline you would like?
Mm.
Totally reasonable. And now the onus is back on them to start working with you rather than saying instant yes. And so this default no is a way of just making sure your boundaries are asserted, and grounding means you're not getting triggered. And having a mantra is going to stop you from getting into things that are going to cause you resentment later.
You know why I love that? It's not just because of having a default yes, but it's also, we have a default beyond the no. So, no, let me explain, I can't do this, uh-huh. But this, and we over-explain ourselves.
Uh-huh.
We shouldn't.
And you know, and it's funny, people do this to me quite a bit. they say, I can't do it because of this, and this, and this, and this. And so...
The listicle.
Right. But the thing is, I will take the weakest thing that you tell me, and I will go, I can solve that for you. And I'll go, no, but this. And I'll go, I can also solve that for you.
Mm.
And then we get down to the one reason why you really don't want to do it. And so my advice is always, pick one strong reason why you don't want to do it, and just give people that.
I love that. That is good advice. Tell me that's not good advice. That's brilliant advice. Have your mantras ready. Write them down and rehearse them. Oh, my gosh. Well, this brings me to the next part. So I've taken a few scenarios that came out in our research.
Okay.
And I'm going to go through them. And I mean, we haven't gone through them. And let's see, you know, how we can maybe discuss these scenarios and maybe where the boundary needs to be. And maybe you've got ideas what that boundary could be.
Okay.
So let's take the boardroom, for example, right? During meetings where colleagues are frequently talking over you, dismiss your ideas, or fail to acknowledge your contributions. I mean, this is quite a big thing. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. So I was talking to a conscious leader this week, actually, about this woman. She sat in a boardroom meeting, but she was not allowed to sit at the table. Let me explain to you this mm-hmm. scenario, right? It was quite insane. So at the table, there was name tags for all the people that were allowed to sit there, most of them being white men, right? And then behind them was the rest of the leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman was sitting behind these chairs. And then woman would speak up in this meeting. And one of the ladies that was in the meeting, her boss tried to get some points across in terms of things that had to change for the next fiscal, blah, blah, blah. And they just talked over her. They didn't want to hear her ideas. And it was completely rude. Now, when you listen to that kind of scenario, we often find ourselves where we have things to say, we express our ideas, and then, okay, move on. We're not actually listening to it. How can we bring attention back to, listen, I actually am talking here. I have an idea. Please, can you let me finish?
Okay. I mean, there's so much to unpack there. And I think the first thing is begin with self-reflection. Are you impactful? Are you offering, you know, good ideas? Or were maybe you going on, because it's always useful to take responsibility for something first. Now, the second thing is, sounds like a, inverted commas, toxic, non-psychologically safe culture, in which case, what you do is probably try and leave.
Best advice.
Right. But the third thing is, and this is where this inner sovereignty comes. And what I recommend to my clients is this. You go on the great adventure of the truth. And you just learn to tell the truth. And again, if you can do this from a detached perspective, right? Because the great people we admire are people who told the truth despite it being unpopular. Now, in that culture, telling the truth might cost you political capital, might even cost you your job. Look at whistleblowers. I know one from Eskom who's had to leave the country.
Sure.
Right? So You know, there's sometimes a premium placed on telling the truth in very toxic cultures, but most of the but also that's useful information. And to tell the truth skillfully, so we're not brutalizing anybody, we're not making it personal, but to actually stand up and or not stand up and just say, excuse me, could I finish my point? And to say that point generally will get you kudos and will get you respect. But the level of self-awareness and self-confidence and courage you need to do that, again, comes back to cultivating it inwardly, because that is no small thing to do.
I think what was very interesting with that example that I used was, is a subordinate that goes to the superior and say, why do you allow them to talk to you like that?
Uh-huh.
Or why do you allow them to interrupt you like that?
Uh-huh.
And I think, like, you know, we as women also want to see that our leaders are also smashing the ceiling. But it's sometimes very compromising positions, because they just can't do it. It's just, there's no room for it. There is the way it's done, and there's no way of breaking that cycle.
And
best to leave, right?
If you can, but obviously tough employment market. I told you a story at the beginning. I spent 18 months in that leader did not want to know the truth. And I quickly learned that I would be punished for giving it. So psychological safety is my vulnerability, and it's a vulnerable act to speak up and tell the truth. Is it punished or rewarded? And if there's evidence that you're going to punish me, I'm going to stop doing it, which we call quiet quitting. And I would say, you know, the Pareto principle, 80% of the cultures that I work with in a leadership development capacity, they're default cultures. What's a default culture? It's a head-based culture that doesn't have any idea that culture is a feeling, and that a leader's primary responsibility is that of chief cultural architect.
Hmm.
Culture is a feeling, and therefore my principal responsibility is to create resonance in culture, because as Drucker said, culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Hmm.
The context creates the content. Yet, if you work in one of those organizations, wow. It's beautiful. You go to work and you enjoy it, and you release your discretionary effort.
Love.
And your potential is being fulfilled. But we have to understand that most cultures are legacy default cultures. Now, be the change you want to see, but also understand that you can't really change anybody. You can only change your own reaction and your own behavior.
Mm, love that. Okay, next one. Especially, you know, I believe, as I mentioned to you, as within, so without, as above, so below. If you can't put the boundaries in place in your personal life, you can't put the boundaries in place in your corporate environment.
Uh-huh.
So let's take an example here from a family perspective or friendship perspective, where you have close relationships where people keep on coming to you and asking you for personal favors that is interfering with your personal time with your family, and you don't always want to do what they're asking you to do. Like, how do you set that boundary? No, like, I don't want to do this, without compromising friendships or family gatherings and relationships, and how that could impact you.
Okay, I see this quite a bit. You probably will compromise friendships. Those people aren't your friends, right? They're people who are vampires, and they want stuff from you, and you're useful to them, and they will continue to take stuff until they get it from you.
My husband has a word for that: social climbing.
Right. So social climbing, right? You're a tool, and understand, when people use you instrumentally, they are just using you for their own benefit. What is a friendship? A friendship is mutually beneficial. And if people aren't showing up for you, look, I know you want their validation. I know life is lonely and hard enough, right? But ultimately, again, what we are attached to anchors our position in life, our vibration, you could say. And until I sever the cords with people who don't want the best for me, and who I am helping them fulfill their dream, but they are not helping me fulfill mine, I'm not going to allow space for the people who would reciprocate to come in. So the first thing is, understand that if you set boundaries, there may be consequences. Good.
Mm.
Right? The second thing is, to do it skillfully, use a framework. So the framework I really like is...
I like frameworks.
Right. So the framework I like is something like, you observe what you're seeing. And the rule of three is really useful here. Because if something happens once, maybe you were having a bad day, or maybe also I was having a bad day and just got triggered, right? So I want to see, and second time could just be an accident, coincidence. Third time is a pattern. It's the first number that's a pattern, the rule of three. So I come to you and I say, look, on this occasion, you asked me to do this. I did. I didn't receive a lot of gratitude. And I also feel like my boundaries were breached because I told you and you insisted. And I don't feel like the relationship. So you observe what is happening. Then you state the impact. Right. When you do that, this happens. And maybe it's an emotion. Right. If it's a personal relationship, I would add the emotion in. So you can say, I feel used when you asked me to do all of these things without seeming to enter into reciprocation. It's happened here, here, and here. And then you can request a change in the behavior. You know, would you just consider that my time is also precious, and that on the two times I've asked you for help over the last month, it hasn't been forthcoming. But equally, you should also reinforce people. So the key to a harmonious relationship is a 5-to-1 positive to negative feedback ratio. So when people in my coaching practice talk to me about their relationships, I ask them, 5-to-1? No, I don't compliment, I don't appreciate, I don't give gratitude 5 times for the amount I criticize. So we can also do this. You know, if I was on the end, receiving end of your assistance, to make sure I say, I feel so honored and grateful when you show up for me like that. I just want to know how I can help you do the same. And I just need to say I appreciate you. So we must also remember that feedback should be positive as well.
But it sounds like a lot of work. I'm sorry. But I mean, like, of course you want to do that. But, you know, I think, and I'm just... I'm just being honest, if I may. But I mean, if you have a lot of those scenarios in your life, like if you have to do that with each single one of them, you know, I think that also comes back to you as a person. Is like, why are people doing this? Like, why is this happening?
Yeah.
Too many people are doing this.
Yeah.
What am I doing wrong? Am I setting the right boundaries? Because why do people feel that they can take advantage of me?
Okay. And you know, let's return to the inner creates the outer. We have a feeling tone. You could call it a vibration. Feeling tone works better in corporate. You feel a certain way. And what I know is true is this. Depending on how I feel depends on who I attract, right? You've all met those people who are just beautiful to be around and everybody is falling over to do favors for them. So if you want new friends, do more work on cultivating more self-esteem. Now, this is a really good time to talk about self-esteem, because those delegates I talked to who are newly appointed directors, they didn't have self-esteem. They had title, they had status, but they didn't have self-esteem because those are external markers of power. But inner sovereignty is where self-esteem comes from. Can I tell you how to get self-esteem?
Tell me.
Okay.
All ears.
So self-esteem, status and authority are fear-based and they come from the head. Okay, your head will calculate how much status someone has and how much respect to show them. Your heart, your intuitive feeling heart, is something like your conscience also. So I'm going to ask you, what's the one thing that you're doing that you know you absolutely should stop? You're going to answer in no time at all. And what's the one thing you know that you should absolutely start? And your intuition just delivers you those, and it comes, and maybe now it's running wild and there's a list you need to make. You don't trust yourself and you don't respect yourself and you don't love yourself because you're acting out of alignment with your highest potential. Your intuition knows who is right for you, what is right for you, and what and who isn't right for you. And imagine how much less anxiety you would have if you knew that you were on the path. And that path is an intuitive one. And it speaks to you every day. It says, don't do that, do this. And cultivating that discipline equals freedom.
I love that you said that. I had to make a very big business decision this week. And the first thing that came to mind for me was like, it's not that I'm not ready. It doesn't feel like it's in alignment with me. And the more research I'm doing, I still feel, although everybody says it's the right thing to do, it's not feeling like it's the right thing to do. So I'm not going to, and the moment I said, no, I'm not doing it, it's like I had this peace.
Okay.
And it just like, it was the strangest thing. Although it seems to be the right thing to do, it's not. It's not the right thing for me.
Okay.
And having the courage to know that.
And you know this if you've been in a relationship that doesn't work. I recently had a friend, a lady, who broke up with her boyfriend and they were dream couple. For a year, she said, She knew it wasn't right. And she then, but logically, it made so much sense. And she left, and now she's got her power back and she's thriving. You cannot, that we have logic, okay, which is this computer.
Mm.
But we also have, and remember, Einstein said, intuition is a sacred gift and the rational mind is a faithful servant. We have created a society that honors the servant and has forgotten the gift. Steve Jobs, intuition is more powerful than the intellect. And yet, particularly my male clients, would, if I didn't give those two quotes, deny that intuition is real.
Mm.
And yet, if we listen to it, we can go, and intuition is often non-logical, and it creates faith and it needs trust to listen to it. But when we do, like you say, that sense of inner peace is the consequence.
I like to call it gut vesting.
Uh-huh.
So investing. So the more I gut vest, the more my intuition actually develops and grows. And, you know, Gary Vaynerchuk, I was watching one of his content pieces where he was talking about, we might not understand intuition now, but maybe in 100 years, we will understand the full capacity of what intuition brings to us and the importance of leaning into intuition. So I totally agree with that. I mean, like, it's the compass. Like, if you, it's just everything. And it's almost like the GPS that has got all the coordinates where you need to go in your journey, why you are here. And if you just follow that, it will take you where you need to be.
And I know a little bit about you because we're friends, and your journey has been intuitive. It was non-logical to do some of the things you've done.
I know. Let's not go there.
Right.
Like, I think when I came to you with my big idea, you were like, what?
Well, I wasn't, because it came to you in such a profound way, a vision, right? It was a literal vision. But it's interesting, because let's just dive into intuition a little bit more, right? The signature, so intuition works on feeling. The head works on thought. The signature feeling tone of intuition is meaning. And we experience meaning as resonance. So my business is called Resonance because we know it when we feel it. We can't describe it. We can't measure it. And again, we can't describe feelings using the operating system of thought, the language of which is words. Feelings, the language is emotions. And so when you find something meaningful, right, you started this podcast 6-7 years ago, and that glimmered to you and it was meaningful and you did it, and now here we are. If it's meaningful for you to take a singing lesson, if it's meaningful for you to take a baking course, you have no idea what dots are going to be connected down the road. But you need to follow them, even though it might appear silly to those around you.
Oh, I love that. Love that. I've got many more. Wait. There might be a lot more wisdom coming. Yeah. Okay. Listen. Okay. So I don't know if you've ever been in a meeting, but we as women experience this a lot, where it's automatically assumed that you're going to be doing the minutes.
Okay.
And like, you're often asked to take the notes, organize the meetings, or handle administrative tasks because you are the woman. How do you say, can we actually like rotate this responsibility? It's not just my responsibility, especially in a board meeting.
Okay. So the third,
unless it's your role, right?
So are you the? I remember this was my job when I first worked in an investment team, and I did that gladly. And so just make sure that you're not ego tripping. But if it's not your role and you're not bottom of the food chain, so to speak, and rising, then it's quite simple. You just speak the truth compassionately, right? So you don't, detached is a better word. So you just say, you know, I think it would be, fair is a very powerful word. I think it would be fair if we shared the minutes because I would like to participate more.
I love that. Don't you like that? Because it's so true. I am such a terrible minute taker, but I'm always asked to do it. And I'm like, no, I don't want to do it.
No.
Okay. Anyway, that was a selfish one for me. Okay. So here's another one that that came up a lot in our research, where women have found they are parents, or sometimes they're single parents, and decisions get made on their behalf why they can't be in a project, or why they can't travel, or why they can't go to that event. How do they set a boundary to say, can I please make that decision? That's not your decision to make. Because these decisions are sometimes made in the name of being considerate, but it's not considerate.
It's so interesting. So again, assumptions are resentments in waiting, and people are making assumptions about you. So it's your job to provide clarity, which is just going to mean having a meeting. And again, detachment, 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 which requires equanimity, which requires some cultivation of, call it Zen, right, where you quiet your mind and you have these processed emotions. So we go in and we just say, hey, can I speak to you? I would really love to be involved in some of these projects. And I was just wondering why there wasn't a discussion about me coming. I'm curious. Curious is wonderful because you can't be triggered when you're curious. I'm curious, what would I need to do to get on these projects? And, you know, it may be that it's nothing to do with you having children and your assumptions are wrong. It may, you know, and now we're just uncovering the truth. So if we can detach, if we can be curious, and we can understand that our aim is to get to the truth, invariably we will.
Love. Okay. So I want to talk about also micromanagers and, you know, those people that don't give you autonomy, that undermine you. So if you have a superior that constantly criticizes your work, micromanages your projects, or takes credit for your achievements, how do you handle that one?
Okay. So first of all, understand where this is coming from. Many leaders, some leaders are jealous and they are threatened. Right. So we see that particularly when job markets are tight, right? Here in South Africa, not an infinite number of jobs, and people, I've worked for a leader who was terrified of me and of losing their own position. And that creates a certain set of behaviors. So we understand that we're dealing with someone coming from fear, right? It's not pleasant, but it's true. So the next thing we want to do is have a conversation and say, you know, look, do you find my work of a reasonable standard? Because again, self-reflection, is it me? Are my expectations too high? Have I only been in the job 1 month? Am I even doing it well? Right? If it turns out that we can agree that I am, you can guide people on how to manage you. And you can say, you know, respectfully, what would really help for me is if you set me up for success at the beginning and we had check-ins once a week rather than ad hoc. And you can give some reasons for why. So that's an excellent way to enter into, to create an agreement about how you wish to be managed. Now, whether or not the leader is receptive or not, you won't know, but you don't want to sit there simmering in resentment if you didn't find out.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's two parts to this, because the one thing is, like, to your point, like, it could be criticizing you and really wanting you to improve, but there needs to be a coaching element to that in order to get there, right? But I think the other part of it is also, how many times have you been criticized and then about an idea, and then that idea becomes that person's entitlement, and then they walk around saying, this is my idea, and I've come up with this idea, and actually they wanted the person to feel like they're not good enough, or that idea doesn't belong to them, but actually took that idea and made it their own. It happens a lot.
It happens a lot, and it's happened to me. And I would counsel, the first thing is, the leader's job is to take responsibility for bad things and share credit for good things, right? That's what an ideal leader would do. But ultimately, we do pass work up, and it is the leader who gets the accolades. So the first thing I would ask is, why do you want the credit? Quite often, it's an ego thing. Now, in my experience, when you do the work, small t, small w, when you do the work.
What is small t, small w?
Well, the work is when we work on ourselves. The work is when we do it for the corporation and we get paid for it. So when we do work, the workplace has a way of ultimately rewarding people who are industrious and competent. Right? Competency is generally comes up. And what I'm counseling against here, and I think, I know I was hyper ambitious. And if you're 24 and you're 6 months into a role and you think people are taking credit for your ideas, well, maybe that's just part of the creative process. So that's the first thing. But if it is something that's happening systemically, then again, what we do is we sit down and we say, hey, you know, I love creating these ideas. Is there any way that we could co-credit what I do? because I really enjoy being part of this process. And I feel, again, this beautiful word, it would be fair that my input was credited.
I love that. I love that because it's like, thank you so much. It's almost like, thank you so much for appreciating and loving my ideas. I would like to do more of that, but maybe we can do it together, you know, and almost have a positive swing to it. Because, you know, if you hold it in, it can become very toxic within yourself as well. If you don't express your feelings,
and for much of my life, again, that comment you made, like, why did no one tell me this before? A lot of the time I would go into these conversations seething. The reason I can teach what I do is because I've done it wrong so many times, right? And so understanding that our job, and again, if you don't have an intention, I mean, so few people even have an intention for the day when they wake up. They just wake up, they turn their Wi-Fi on and they check the news and get a load of negative headlines in their consciousness. But the same is true as having an intention for the day, as having an intention, an outcome for the meeting. What my intention here is to keep my feeling tone high, to not get triggered, and to partner with this person to find out if we can do this. And what you'll find is the intention derives the direction and also the feeling of the conversation. Whereas if I go in gangbusters, I'm going to get heard now. Very different outcome.
Yeah. But, you know, I also want to talk to that. So the other day I was having a conversation around, and just to bring it back to myself, it's like I'm the kind of person, I connect hard, I love hard.
Yeah.
Right? But then if I don't protect my own space and my boundaries, I sometimes the masks comes off, but when they start coming off, I get to see what I didn't see before, where obviously I didn't listen to my intuition in the beginning. But that loving hard is also exit hard. So it's important also to find that balance. And that's something I'm working on. Uh-huh. It's very important to me is to say, okay, right, how can I maybe slow in with relationships that I don't need to be so attached to them in the beginning and rather attach myself at a later point until I see the mask come off and see if I like that person without the mask.
I think the technical term is love bombing.
No, man, that is probably a Gen Alpha. Oh my gosh, love bombing. Yes, okay, love bombing.
But it's a really good, it's something I think not all of us struggle with. Agreeable people will see the best in others and they will be eager to show their love. And again, I am more agreeable than disagreeable. I've had to learn the polarity. And it's interesting, by the way, you know, wisdom is the reconciliation of polarities. We're all born on one end of the spectrum. When we can do both, then we become wise. And then it's a timing issue, which is more appropriate. And, you know, the most helpful people in your life are those who are best at detachment. It's the paradox, right? We are detached and we love everyone equally until such a time when we are shown that it is time to assert our boundaries. And so this outpouring of love is overexposing us to some extent, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
Right? But if we can love from a dispassionate place, and this is the idea of there's a divine in everybody. Namaste. The light in me sees the light in you. Everybody is worthy of love. And yet some people are more worthy of boundaries than others.
I love that. I wonder sometimes if ADHD has something to do with that because we don't like structure, right? No. I'm going off script. No, I will completely break down this entire conversation. Okay, I'm going to go with two more examples because we don't have time for more. I'm going to take a personal one that came up quite a lot in our research as well. I just want to see where it is. When family members criticize your life choices, often criticizing your career choices and the career that you want to do rather than like many times family members would say, or your parents would say, I'm paying for your studies. You have to go and study a lawyer or you have to go and study to become an accountant. And it sometimes goes against what you want to do. Or you've been criticized for the relation status, who you love, how you parent, and often being left feeling judged. Like, how do you set a boundary to say, I know what's best for me and I have the experience. When I need help, I will come to you.
So Carl Jung said, the greatest and I'm paraphrasing here, the greatest challenge parents impose on their children is their own unlived lives. Right? So when your parents are telling you, you know, you need to become a lawyer or a doctor or whatever, I mean, my wife was told to become a pharmacist. And so she went through many years and ultimately understood that she really didn't like that career. And so has had that experience. Now, there's a couple of things at play. So the first thing is, if lots of people are triangulating you and telling you something, you should listen to feedback and you should take it on. And I think the extent to which you have activated your intuition determines the extent to which you should discard feedback. I left a very successful corporate career 5 or 6 years ago now. And I had my mother and my best friend tell me I was delusional. But I had this inner knowing that I was walking my path. And unless you've activated that, you are subject to the voices in your head. And the voices in your head are going to tell you to go open a bar, go open whatever the thing is. Those are relatively random ideas versus the one big intuitive idea, which I know you've had. And how you know this, the logical ideas will justify themselves. Logic justifies itself. Intuition simply knows. It's a very deep feeling, and it tends to come in a great big mega insight where your whole body feels that this is your destiny. And that appears irrational because it's non-rational, illogical because it's feeling-based. So if you have that feeling that this is your intuitive destiny and you've done the capital D, capital W work of activating and listening to your intuition, and I don't know how you do that if you don't have a morning prayer, meditation, gratitude practice where you get quiet to listen for signal, to quiet the noise in the mind, and open to the signal in the heart. If that's happened to you, then you will encounter resistance. And reality, through the mechanism of people, will try and distract you. First, it will try and tell you not to do it. Then it will offer you temptations to subvert you. And it will say, why don't you just take this well-paying corporate job instead of pursuing your destiny, you know? And so you're going to get called delusional. Then you're going to get tempted out of pursuing it. And then ultimately you enter into, and it's useful to think about a mythical archetype here, which is the one our culture is founded on. Moses is in Egypt. He's part of Egypt. That I think of as the tyranny of the head, symbolically, metaphorically. Then he goes into the desert, and there he's getting rid of all these attachments of everything that doesn't serve him, which is people, which is friendships, which is material comfort. And then once you achieve that test, a baptism of fire, you get into the promised land of your destiny. But there's a price to be paid.
Profound. Yissy, I am being helped today. How about you? Okay, last one before we close off. So I wanted to close off with the following. This came up a lot as well. How often there would be golf days that excludes people from that. It's only like, you know, certain people that are allowed to go to these informal gatherings where important networking happens, which affects, especially women, affects visibility. And women, like many times, would say, I play golf so I can be be there for important networking events. How, and like also nepotism, I've experienced that in my career, where there is social circles within the working environment, and there's weekend get-togethers, and where all of the networking actually happens, and it's very hard to find your place because these things are happening, and you're never invited to these events, even the actually considered to be invited. So I would like to ask: is being excluded from networking and social events, and if you notice that it's happening quite a lot, how do you have that conversation?
Okay, so the first stage of psychological safety is inclusion, right? And inclusion isn't what you think, it's not what I thought. So we have in-groups, again, we're wired to have in-groups and out-groups, right? And 1 in 5 people you meet are going to like you, 1 in 5 people are just going to dislike you, and 3 in 5 people are going to be agnostic about you. That's a really helpful thing to know, because it's not personal, it's just the way we're wired. Now, the job of a leader is to not stick in the 1 out of 5, which is what most people do, drinking buddies, It's to bring along the three out of five who are kind of on the wall, and also bridge, rather than bond, bridge to the people who are, I would rather exclude because it's uncomfortable and difficult for me, because your hair's different, because you're, whatever the differences are, we just don't resonate. But I have a responsibility to create resonance. So that's the first principle of psychological safety as a leader. So if you're a leader, ask yourself, do I bridge into every sector of my team, or do I actually have a little clique? Because then you are exclusive, even if you invite people into the room. Right. So that's from the leadership perspective. If you're being excluded, the first thing I would ask is, how important is it for you to go to the golf day? I spent years and more time and money than I would care to admit learning to play golf, right? And I could play sport at school. Golf is a different proposition. I wasn't very good at it, and it used to frustrate me, because you know you don't play to your handicap 80% of the time. So 80% of the time you feel like you failed, and like it's just a very frustrating game. So I counsel, golf is a good walk spoiled, Mark Twain said. I kind of agree with him now. So like, do you even want to go, is the first thing. When it comes to these corridors of power, it's important to be authentic and be yourself and have people opt in. And what I've seen work is when people create their own kind of events, their own kind of, because we're talking about business development here, presumably for golf, right? And unless it's a golf firm, then there's going to be women who want an away day too. And so what do women like doing? And I don't want to start stereotyping here, but you could think of what you like doing. You could start canvassing, and all of a sudden, you're actually moving into this untapped market where there is no attention, there is no spend, there is no budget, and you create your own pillar of influence. And you don't have to go play golf. You don't have to go get drunk. You can go and do things that you enjoy that resonate with your clientele. And that is the best thing I can recommend, because it's staying true to your authenticity, but it's also tapping something that's non-obvious and therefore higher value.
Yeah. I agree, but I also feel that there needs to be both sides. Like, there needs to be a come together conversation around it, because I feel like we almost need to create inclusive spaces. But, you know, at the same token, is like, we also have to look at women empowerment and how we are creating our own spaces. Like Conscious Leaders is one example.
Right.
We are creating a safe space for women, expressing women's issues, talking about how we lead differently, how, you know, we lead from boardroom to living room, how we really come together in unity and how we can drive impact. Because women, we as women, you know, if you put money in our hands, money is not, it goes to the community. It goes to empowering those around us. It's very different.
And coming back to what I talked about, agreeableness and the way women are wired to be inclusive. And that's why, you know, the world is going through a shift, right? And it is going through a shift. And the evidence is incontrovertible. Psychological safety creates high performance. That's Google, that's Harvard, that's MIT. The first principle of psychological safety is inclusion safety. Women do it naturally because I told you they want harmony and they're nurturers, right? And the job of a leader, the primary job, and almost no leaders know this or even would say it about themselves, is to create harmony and nurture talent so that indirect contribution can come. Leaders, the proper analogy for a leader is the conductor of an orchestra. The conductor of an orchestra makes no sound, and yet they are the one that gets the contribution from everybody else, and they give that to everyone. So if you're in a culture where there is no inclusion safety, I don't know how you go about changing that. But I do know, as a leader, what you can do is lead by example. And I have seen the most profound shifts of the females I coach, where people start to opt into their way of leading because it feels so good to be around. And ultimately, we're at work so much, we can make it good to go to and to feel to be in. And that starts with what you've touched on, making yourself inclusive so that others can see the example you're creating and opt into it.
Love it. David, this was such an extraordinary conversation. I wish we could have more of them. We should definitely make room for more of them. I feel that it's such a necessary conversation. And who would have known that communication can go in so many streams of our lives, right? Yeah. It is really like the pillar that, or the magnet that, you know, that we express ourselves in and out of the world. Yeah, so thank you so much for all the wisdom and knowledge. I hope you've taken notes. If not, you have to rewatch this. And we'll put David's contact details below. So if you want to reach out to him directly. So any parting thoughts from yourself?
One thing. Brené Brown, in all her years of research, found that what we're ultimately after is to create a feeling tone that other people want to be around. And if we can create that feeling tone of sovereignty, of power, then the inner creates the outer and great things happen, right? Mm-hmm. She's never met a single person who would describe their inner life as joyful, who didn't. And think about it. If you could have anything, right? If you chose a material thing like $1 million, you would still be you. And you would still have all your problems, and it would still be the same, just different problems. The right thing to aim at, perhaps, would be an inner life of joy, regardless of external circumstances. That is achievable. In her statistics, about 20% of people get there. They're the people, by the way, that have entered this heartfelt, intuitive space. Now, she never met a single person who would describe their inner life as joyful who did not have a daily gratitude practice. So what I would like to do, if it's okay with you, Carmen,
of course,
is to just go back into the intelligence of our body, wiggle your toes, breathe up your feet, imagine pure light energy coming through, let it touch the top of your chest, sigh out any negativity that doesn't serve you, ground it. One more time, breathing in beautiful pure light energy, awareness in the breath. You might feel your neck rolling because you're taking a holiday from your head. And now place one hand over your heart. Think of somebody or something you are grateful for. And now move your breath, your awareness, your intention, your energy into the space between your hand and your heart. And feel gratitude. Plato told us that great minds that practice gratitude attract great things. And I have experienced that to be true. There are 1,440 minutes in a day. Maybe begin by practicing gratitude for just one and see what happens. Thank you.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you so much. Well, there you have it. To be a conscious leader is not just about the question that you ask yourself as how I can lead with greatness, but the call of a conscious leader is how can I bring the greatness out in those around me. So to all of you, thank you so much for tuning in, and have a marvelous time watching this over and over and over and over and over and over and over. Thank you so much. Bye-bye now.
Thank you.
Cheers.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.